days. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on bluechipspeakersnaba.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. I'm delighted tonight to introduce our speaker. I do not know Heather, but I can just tell you that I love her already, because she's doing something I had to do when I was a mom, and I had to bring my children to A meetings every once in a while, and I knew that it really made some people upset. But you know what? It takes a lot of courage to agree to tell your story and have your best buddy in the audience for you. So with that, I'm going to give you Heather and Phoenix.
Yeah, amen. What up, y'all? I'm Heather, an alcoholic addict. I appreciate your patience with him. I'm a single mother, and he's going through serious separation anxiety, so it is what it is right now. So he will play, and he will be good. What it's like today and what it was like then. And first of all, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Y'all pack a big house, holy hell. I always think about that when I'm asked to speak on the way there, and every time it's different. What some of the most simple things that are different for me now are maybe simple to regular people, but they're really profound for me. Like today I was thinking on the way here, I have issues with anxiety, and today was a jam-packed day. I've got 15-year-old twins in the next room over, and they're stressing about homework and hormonal, and homeboy's not having the most chill day, and I was low on gas on the way here, so I had to pull over and get gas. And the gas station owner is using the bathroom, so I'm thinking that I pulled in the wrong gas station. And then we get rerouted in construction, and I'm just like laughing at that point. Like, right on, bring it on, you know. We're going to get there by the skin of our teeth, and we'll figure it out. And I have the ability to stop and pray and pause and ask for guidance and not completely kirk out, because the way it was before was, my anxiety was so debilitating, there's no way I would have made it here. I would have told you I was coming, and I would have ditched out, and I would have lied to you why. I wasn't honest, and I had no means of managing my life. I ran the show, and I didn't run it well. So, are you eating? Eat. Every time I pause to tell this, as of recent, I had opportunity to write my story, and I published it online, and that made me think a lot more, because when I speak in front of people, I guess my brain runs in one way, but when I had to take pen to paper and write it down in chronological order and in fashion that someone else would be able to understand, it made me start thinking about a whole lot more stuff, and my addictions and my alcoholic behavior started far before I became problematic. And I do realize that this is Alcoholics Anonymous and not NA, and I hope that I don't offend any of you all when I do sort of highlight, for lack of a better word, on my drug use, because for me, to omit that is not really including my entire story. I wouldn't really be a head case until later in life, and I was a wrecking ball far earlier than that. So when I start thinking about when my addictive personality presented itself or became recognizable, I was probably, well, I mean, in the womb, but as far as recognizable to others, I was like probably 13, 14, and I had full-blown eating disorders. I was bulimic and anorexic. I'd not eat my breakfast, not eat my lunch, and pick up my dinner. I was a talented athlete, and I don't know how I managed to do those. After that, I started popping white crosses to stay skinny, pink hearts and black beauties, because they were legal. And I was way, you know, off on that one. But I didn't drink, and I didn't smoke, and I didn't do drugs, because those weren't drugs to me, because they were legal, and you could buy them at a gas station. But I didn't do those other things because I was still a goody two-shoes, and I had the fear of my parents. My father's a retired Army general. He's 6'6" and about the most physically domineering man you've ever met. And my mother is 5'1" and she is no less foreboding. She is frightening and thinks she's dynamite from small packages. I used to call my parents the Great Santini and Rasputin, for those of you who know that literary reference. and they were no joke. So I didn't so much have any real fear of getting in trouble anywhere other than at home. I would be like, call the cops, throw my bug ass in jail, just don't call my parents. I was deathly afraid of getting in trouble with my parents, and I was in trouble most all the time. I was grounded 9 months of my freshman year, and I started bucking the system, and I've had a resistance, or I've had a loathing. Resistance is such a nice word. I've had a loathing for authority ever since I can remember. When I was 15, all my teachers had a conference, and they said, our problem with Heather is that she manipulates the system. And I said, they asked me what I thought about it. And I said, well, I think if a 15-year-old so easily manipulates your system, perhaps you should revise your system and not the 15-year-old. And there was a split second of, like, whoa, on my dad's face. Like, that was a smart-ass answer. But I got grounded for being disrespectful. And I was always like that. I was pushing it just the line enough that I could say that I didn't break the rules, but I manipulated the rules, and I think that pissed people off even more because it was very manipulative, and it wasn't, basically you just say screw you, when you break the rules, it's just screw you, you know, but if you try to do some antics and do it around and pretend that you're still trying to do the right thing, it seems a little more, I don't know, it's deliberately not nice, I suppose. Through school, through high school, I didn't really mess up too much. I mean, I started getting into drinking. I drank a couple times my junior year, and it wasn't really for me because I was a complete and total control freak. I liked being in control, and I liked not, I didn't like not being, having my wits about me. And drinking didn't enable me to do that. So my senior year, I've been to three high schools in those 3 years, and managed to be vice president of my class every year in three different schools, and played sports, and I was a big personality because you had to be in my house. There was no not getting it done. There was no weakness. There was no room for failure. You just figured out how to do it and to be right and to get your point across and to conquer. So I say I had this big personality. I had a big, huge set of armor is what I had, because inside I didn't ever feel like I fit in. I didn't ever feel normal. I didn't ever feel accepted. I never felt good enough, like perpetually not good enough. And I mean, it could have been on anything, and it didn't matter how much I excelled or exceeded, or the accolades that I attained, or the accomplishments that I managed to get. I never felt good enough, you know, in any way. I always felt sort of, I don't know, just like, fundamentally jacked up as a person, if that makes any sense. Just like I was sort of damaged goods and just bad. I mean, that's like this is the most simplistic of words, but I just felt bad. I didn't feel good about myself. Senior year, I discovered marijuana and decided I was going to graduate at semester and screw off the full ride scholarships I had across the East Coast because I was done with high school. I had enough credits at semester, and I was tired of it. I went to my high school graduation drunk as a skunk from my own apartment. Thought I was pretty cool for that. And right after that, I started runway modeling, and I discovered meth. I'm 153 pounds now. I modeled at 118. And was on a pretty hardcore drug path for a bit. And then I woke up one day, and the women that I modeled with, I was 18 and 19, sit now. The women that I modeled with were older than I. And I saw what was happening to them, and I saw this one woman was turning 29, and she thought her life was over, and I couldn't get it. She was a beautiful woman, and she was extremely capable, but she didn't think she had anything other than her face and her outward appearance. So I woke up one day and decided I was going to put the meth down. Didn't do it again, didn't touch it again, didn't surround myself with those people. It's always amazed me that the highly addictive drugs, I could just wake up one day and decide I was done with, but I couldn't do it with alcohol. After that, I started cocktailing in a strip club, And the best way to get the best sections in the strip club is to sell the most drinks. Best way to sell the most drinks is the hustle. And the hustle drinks, you bet your... We had five tables with five seatings at each table. So you could have 25 open tabs, cash and carry at any given time. You bet your customers you can drink more than them, and they have to pay the tab. There was quite a few times. One time I remember drinking 16 shots of tequila with one customer. I don't know how much I was drinking with everyone else. And then after we were done with work, we would go out, you know, go out and party. Because the neighboring bars that would come in and see us during the day, we wouldn't give them a tab. We just hook them up with drinks, and then we would go out afterwards and do the same thing. So you kind of drink for free, you know. And I drink around the clock pretty much at that point. 21, 22, and I didn't think any of this was alcoholic behavior because we all did the same thing. When I got to work in the morning and my bartender put out a Bloody Mary for me and asked me if I wanted celery in it or not, it wasn't an alcoholic way to start the day. It was just what we did. You know, you either wanted celery or you didn't. That's the big deal. You know, it wasn't like, it wasn't even taboo. You know, we did it in front of the managers and the way we rolled. That was the first time in retrospect I can see that I had some adverse effects from drinking, although I didn't recognize that that's what it was at the time. I woke up with some really heavy-duty anxiety a couple times, and, you know, just like an inability to catch my breath and an inability to think straight, and I don't know what I thought it was. I thought I was just having an off day, I guess. And then when I got to work and had my Bloody Mary, I was fine. And that didn't click with me. You know, the whole bite what bit you thing, I wasn't putting two and two together yet. I was just like, oh, shitty morning, man. Let's see, a little around that time, I guess some of that started getting worse. I remember going to an urgent care once because I thought I was having some allergy issues and getting breathing treatments. I was like, yeah, it's just my chest is tight. I'm just having a bad day. And she asked me if I was under a lot of stress. And I've been chaotic my entire life. So, yeah, the answer to that one was yes. And I said, well, yeah, I suppose I am. And she gave me a tranquilizer. And within like 15 minutes I was fine. And so then like one little light bulb comes on that, you know, something I'm doing. And even then, it's not me, it's my surroundings, it's my life, it's what others are doing to me that is giving me this anxiety. It's got nothing to do with me and my actions. Let's see here. At 22, I had twins. I was not in love with the man I was going to spend my life with. I was partying hard and got knocked up. That's the long and short of it. Wasn't ready to be pregnant. When I found out I was pregnant, I went out and got as jacked up as I could. I did as many drugs and drank as much as I could and smoked as many cigarettes as I could, hoping that it would solidify my decision to have an abortion. And all it did is make me sick as hell. I think probably the sickest I've ever been, and hate myself. And decided that I wasn't going to do it again, and that I was going to have the baby. And then I went to the doctor, and the doctor showed me the babies. And I was like, shit, because I was not ready to be pregnant. I was 22 and partying hard, and I was so cool. Actually, I was 21 when I got pregnant. Delivered at 22. When I was pregnant with them, I stopped everything. I stayed stuck for a while when they were little and I was nursing. And then up until, I don't know, they were like probably 6 or 8 months old, I started to gradually kind of get back in, you know, just a drink at night and then a cigarette at night and a little this, a little that. And before too long, I was rolling again. At that point, I start biting what bit me in the morning because I don't like the effects, and I realize that if I just have a drink in the morning that my day runs much more smoothly. And I carry those little shooters with me because I know that you shouldn't have an open container. So I'm so smart. I got those little shooters with me most everywhere I go, and I kind of just like toss back a few shots of vodka throughout the day. And I didn't really get, I mean, like when I went out or when I had, I mean, on occasions I got like, you know, tore up, but mostly I just kind of kept a pretty even state buzz. And I left the girl's father, and he stalked me for a while. I was one of the first five people in Montgomery County that had a 911 tracking device. It's a cell phone that you hit send, and it has a tracking device on it. And I had multiple restraining orders and ex partes and all that jazz against him. and I he broke in my house, kidnapped my kids. Things were not good, so I started drinking more just to be able to go to sleep. Like, before, I was a party drinker, I was a recreational drinker, and now my drinking, there was a need, like a tangible a need that I could tell you I needed to drink because I needed to sleep. I couldn't relax. I had to call my neighbor when I was going to take out my trash because we didn't know if I was going to come back in or go missing. So it was a stressful time, and there again, I wasn't drinking because I had a problem. I was drinking because if you had my life, you would too. And it's always, you know, it was always that way. It was always the things that were outside of me that were influencing me, and I just was merely, you know, I'm just responding to the circumstances around me. None of it is my doing. At that point, let's see here, my girls, which I gauge everything by how old they were. I'm terrible with years because I fried my brain. I used to be so much smarter. At least I thought I was. But this time I start, I'm not doing any other drugs because drugs are illegal. And but I'm drinking a lot. And I start... I get a DUI in 2001, and I remember that I was going. I had been doing the things that I did all the time. I had been drinking throughout the day, and I went out with a buddy of mine that night who I drank with before, and so he knew how much I could hold. So when I only had a few drinks at dinner, he's like, "All right, I'm sure she's cool to drive." But I've been drinking all day. So when I get pulled over going northbound on the highway, I had been the other way. This is up in D.C. I'd been the other way earlier in the day, and the cop asked me where I'm coming from, and I was told in the opposite direction, like as if I was going southbound on the highway. And he says to me, like, "Do you even know what you just said?" And I was like, "Yeah, I just, you know, I had a glass of wine, I'm a little bit turned around." So he makes me take a sobriety test, and I say stupid stuff like, "I can't do this shit sober. I was in a car accident, and I obtained a closed head injury, and it did mess with me a little bit, but I guess I just omit that because the things I did to myself were far more damaging, I think, than the car accident was." So I pretty much admitted I was drunk. Before that, I had decided, we were outside an Outback, and the Outback had this, it wasn't even a pond. It's like a man-made watering hole where geese used to go and float on the water and drink. And in my drunken stupor, it was a freaking Mecca lake to me when I came out of that restaurant, and I decided to get naked and swim in it. And I had thrown my clothes on the side on all this goose shit. And so when he's giving me the sobriety test and I'm out of the car, I'm noticing all this crap on my clothes, and I'm like, "What is that?" And he's like, "Maybe you shit yourself." And I was a belligerent asshole, you know. And that started it. So I started in with Ossifer from Clarence Thomas. I was like, "Ossifer, this is harassment." And I was just a jackass. And I ended up getting arrested. I won't blow because I'm thinking I'm so smart that I'm not going to blow. I'm going to get to the police station. By that time, I will have sobered up. Later, the AA classes taught me the exact adverse. So I'm thinking, that's my plan. I'm not going to blow. I'm going to get there. I'm going to sober up. I'm going to be golden. And I remember I had these ridiculous platform heels on. I had this little top and my boobs like shoved up to my chin. And so when he handcuffed me, I'm like popping out everywhere. And I ask him, "Can you let my hands go so I can fix my top?" And he won't. And that's it. I just start with the F-bombs. And then I was so out of control. But I remember all of this. So when we get there, they call in a magistrate, and I still won't blow. 2.5 hours later, I'm thinking I'm golden. By then, I blow at 2.6, or 0.26 rather. And so I get locked up for the night, and then I'm nice to the cops, and I'm crying. "You know, can't you just stay with me? I'm sorry." "It's like, you're a mess." So I stay for the night. I end up on that DUI. I have no criminal record. I have no record at that point. And the Commonwealth of Virginia decides to slam me with the harshest penalty possible. I serve 5 days in jail. I get an interlock system put on my car, and I am remanded to ASAP classes, which is what we call them up there. They're alcohol education classes and AA. So I get introduced to these lovely rooms, and I don't want Jack to do with y'all. I see AA as a bunch of just old people that talk about going to dances with DJs and play bingo, and I am entirely too cool to be part of your crew. We say, you know, find someone that has what you want. They don't want any of it. I just didn't want to get in trouble anymore. I didn't want to get locked up. And ASAP did nothing for me but give me an education that I feel perpetuated my drinking for years, because that tasty little tidbit about the fact that you can die from alcoholic DTs and not any other drug kept me just like, well, I can't stop now because I got to keep drinking. Wish I'd never learned that, you know? So at this point, that's 2001, 2002, my drinking from 2002 to 2007 just really spirals out of control. I get multiple arrests for drunk in public. Let me think here. Let me slow down in this stress part. I think 4 or 5 stints in detox. And I can give you like some highlights, but I can't give you a chronological recount of the time because my brain is too fried and I was in a blackout a great deal of the time. I walked into a detox one time. My mother and my fiance did a temporary detaining order on me, which means I went to my social worker that the court had appointed me to, and after I meet with her, I say, and I've been drinking nowhere for everyone, you know, just like drinking all day, every day, like it was. And I said, all right, well, I got to go now. I got to pick the kids up from school. And they're like, oh, no, you're not. You know, you're going with us. So 2 sheriff's deputies come in, handcuff me, and take me to detox. I know I'm going, and it's like, you know, it's a done deal. So I'm completely congenial, and I'm having quite a conversation with these guys. I'm giving them nutrition advice on the way in, actually, because that's what they were asking me about. Because when I wasn't drinking, I've always been like this serious athletic workout queen, but I never could stick to it because I'm a binge drinker. So I'm giving them nutrition advice. They go in. I mean, they're really cool. They go to take my blood, and we're waiting on the blood to come back, and it comes back at 0.416. Walking, talking coherently, giving nutrition advice. I don't know if that was my highest. It's the highest one I had recorded. And I wasn't in a blackout. And I can't say that's the worst I felt. And it was a trip because the one sheriff, bless his heart, he looks at me just like shocked. And he goes, how do you feel? And I was like, good right now, man. It's when I come off this shit that's going to suck. I was like, that's why I'm here, because I knew I needed Ativan. I took myself through the DTs probably 4 or 5 times. Seized twice, watched myself once. I remember I couldn't open up my hands. And but there was sometimes when I knew I couldn't come off of it. I couldn't, like, wean myself off of it, so I would go to detox. That time, I think it's real pretty when I come in here now and I say that I'm an alcoholic and addict, because what I am, is a drunk, a junkie, a liar, a whore, and a thief. I think recovering addict and alcoholic kind of sound pretty compared to my behavior during that time. When you're puking and crapping your pants at the same time, don't know which end to take care of first, because that's just how you're rolling. And the minute you puke it up, you're trying to get some more so that you can at least break even and stop shitting yourself. Hooking up with random men. Not taking care of my children. I had to turn my children over to my parents. I alienated, offended, and wrecked everything in my path and everyone. I did a lot of damage. I remember, and just the situations I put myself in, you know. I mean, I remember coming to one time, partying with 6 brothers, and I knew one for an hour. And the fact that I didn't get myself jacked up more often, you know. I mean, I got really, really lucky. God was looking out for me when I wasn't looking out for myself. And then there's two things that for some reason, of all the dumb stuff that I did, I mean, like, I wrecked my car with my kids in it. The chronological timeline is, like, it's not different from some of you in here, I'm sure. But there was 2 things that, for some reason, stand out in my head. My girls must have been 5, and we went on a trip to Atlantic City. And I had been sober, I think, a couple of weeks, and so I guess my fiance thought it was looking promising, and we could go to Atlantic City safely. So we go, and I get a hair up my butt, and I used to always say something like, I smoked then, so I used to say like, I was going to get a pack of smokes, or I was going to get a sandwich, or I was always going to go do something real quick that required me just running out real quick by myself. And I remember I went to the bar, and I sat next to some woman who was, you know, in retrospect, I'm sure alcoholic and totally in the bag, and she and I just hit it off, and we decided we were going to go casino hopping, and I didn't have a purse on me, I didn't have any money, nothing. I just go out, and I ditch my fiance and my kids, and I get this crap a lot, because it was all about me. So I took off, and apparently one of my daughters cried herself to sleep at that hotel door. And every time that one really gets me. And I share that because I hope that that always gets me. I hope that that always bothers me as much as it does now that my baby missed her mama and cried herself to sleep at the hotel door and didn't feel any stability and didn't feel any safety and didn't feel any love. The other one, at that time, there were songs she couldn't listen to on the radio. She just put her little head down, her sweet little head. She put her little head down and cried, and she'd say, listen, it makes me think of mama. And it's funny because those aren't really the biggest, you know, most horrendous things that I did, but those two really get me. And then close to the ending time that I stopped drinking, I used to check myself into a hotel so nobody would bother me. Check myself into a hotel by my damn self and drink. And I'd been on a bender for quite a few days this time, and I remember staying in this hotel room, and you know, the DTs and that anxiety, good gracious, that is not something I would wish on my worst enemy. Holy hell, that stuff is bad, you know. I mean, like, I'd see people grabbing me and stuff coming out of the walls, and I just, you know, I know it wasn't real, but my God, that's just sheer hell on your brain. And I knew if it was going to stop, I had to get some more to drink, and I hadn't taken a shower in like 4 or 5 days because I was afraid that I was going to fall. I was afraid I couldn't stand in the shower, and I'd take the shower down with me. I remember trying to bend over because I couldn't hold a cup. I was too shaky to hold a cup, so I tried to lean over to the faucet and drink like this, and just my hands were, I was just such a mess. And Anna Nicole Smith had just died during that time, so I had the TV on for background noise, and that's what was playing. And I remember having this horribly vivid thought that I was going to die in that bed that night, and that I couldn't do that because I was sure some sweet little woman named Maria was going to come clean that room in the morning, and she's going to find me dead. And Maria was probably working 4 jobs with 5 kids, and she just didn't need that bullshit from me. You know, that was just one more selfish-ass thing that I was going to do, die and have Maria find me. And I mean, and it was funny because that was it. I was just like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it to her. You know, fictitious Maria. So I got up that morning and called a cab and made my way through the lobby praying that nobody would talk to me because I couldn't form a sentence. I couldn't form any words. And I went to a bar, and by the time I got to the bar, it was probably like, oh, I guess like 11. And I picked a bar where I knew I wouldn't know anyone because I wasn't in my hometown at that point. And I positioned myself, and I remember because I can't form a word, but this is how my alcoholic mind is going, and I'm like so on the mission, you know? I position myself at a seat in the bar in front of a mirror because I know that when I take that first drink, it's going to come right back up, and I don't want anyone around me to see me doing this, trying to choke it down or puking and swallowing it again so I can swallow enough alcohol to break even to function. So sure enough, I sit there, and I finally get 6 shots of vodka in me, and I'm starting to be able to breathe. At that point, I drink a little bit more, and I think I decide I'm going to try to eat something, and I go back, and that, it's funny, I had to get that okay, if you will, so that I could get myself to detox. So that was the last time I went to detox, and just because I had been drinking for so many days at that point. Each spender got progressively longer and much more destructive. I don't know how much alcohol I was consuming at that point, because I just don't know. But I went to detox in February, and I remember I got out on February 13th, and 2007, and I stayed longer that time, like, this is one of the things that, you know, when you talk to someone, when we approach someone in here or outside of here, we talk about planting the seed. You know, I think you never know when you're doing that, because later with people, things can resonate with them or can manifest in them, rather, or sort of cultivate, you know, and then the thoughts and something that someone said quite a long time ago that didn't have any real importance at that point can mean something later. Because I've been to detox several times, and I was always just trying to get the hell out of Dodge as soon as I could. After I taught my exercise classes, when I'd sober up and detox, they started making me teach exercise classes because I was a frequent flyer. And I thought it was fabulous. That was my service work. So, such a jackass. So I remember I came home, I stayed there longer because that time I really wanted to be there. I was tired of the way I was living. I was tired of being sick and tired, and I didn't want to do it anymore, but I didn't really know what to do differently. You know, I would come into the rooms and I would say, you know, I remember this guy asked me what happened, and I was like, I'm just trying so hard. And he's like, well, then why don't you stop trying? And I was like, well, that's a stupid thing to say. And I always thought that was something I couldn't get my head around, because the way I grew up, if you want something, try hard. Try until you get it done. You know, don't give up. And I just was trying my way, and I was going to keep on trying, and it was not working. So I got out on February 13th, and I remember one of the guys that I was in there with called me afterwards and asked if I wanted to drink, and I was like, no, I'm not drinking, you know, I'm going to do this. And then on April 1st, I decided to drink because I was indignant about the fact that I had suggested to my fiancé that we take the kids to the beach, and he was a jerk about it, and you know, it hurt my feelings. I didn't feel appreciated. And so I went out drinking. And I remember thinking, oh, it's April 1st. We can just say it's an April Fool's. It won't count. And April 4th was my last drink. And on April, because when I came home, everybody was gone. He had taken the kids to the beach without me. And I hadn't heard from them, and nobody had called me, and nobody said they missed me, and nobody said they wished I was here. And it was wild. That was the one time that I can remember that I didn't get arrested. I didn't physically jack myself or someone else up. No physical altercations, because that was all the time for me. I was looking to brawl. I didn't wreck anything. I didn't get in any trouble that time. None. It was an uneventful drunk for me. And that's what it was. It was coming home, hello, to an empty house and realizing that life was moving on and I wasn't with it. And it was not just life of others. It was life of my children that had finally become used to the fact that mommy wasn't reliable and mommy was not going to be there when you needed her. And that really bothered me. And I felt utterly alone, and I felt like an absolute and utter failure. I could feel it other things, and as long as I still had one foot in like the winner's circle, you know what I mean? Like, and I thought I was managing my life, like I was still working or I was still doing this. I thought I was hanging. But when a 5-year-old thinks you're a loser, and it's a 5-year-old that matters, well, any five-year-old. But that was rough. That was really rough. And I went. That was the first time that I went to AA with humility, and I was defeated. I used to always come to these rooms trying to beat the system. You know, I was going to not drink and go home and smoke a bong hit or whatever it was. Can you go sit down for mommy? Go sit down and get your bulldozer. Watch the cord. You're being a good boy. Thank you. It was the first time I went and I sat there and I had no other place to be. That last bender, my boss had figured out that they used to call me, I used to say I had the stomach flu, because I'd be absent from work for like 7 to 10 days on the regular, and I've been always into the bodybuilding, so I would drop like 10 to 15 pounds of muscle in a week, and I'd come back like all, and I'd say, oh, I have stomach flu, and so they call me the sickest healthy person they know. They're like, that Heather is the sickest healthy person we know, because, you know, I was like, eat right and exercise. So they finally figured it out, you know. know, they're like, she's either on drugs or she's drinks. Something's not right with this chick and her perpetual stomach flu. The fiance was like, see ya, you know, I told you that was the last time, and my kids were over. I turned them over to my parents. So I had zero place to be and zero things to worry about, and I had nothing in my life that I could say I was succeeding at or that I was doing well at, that I was even hanging with, and I felt like an utter failure, and that gave me the ability to give up, and giving up gave me the ability to surrender. I often share in the rooms that when people talk about surrendering their will, that to me demonstrates grace. It demonstrates a conscious decision to do something different, to do something better, and I can't give myself that much credit. There was no decision for me to surrender my will or to try to do something different. I just said F it, because I was tired of trying, and I was broken, and I was beat and defeated. And so I just sat there, and I did what I was told to do, which was the first time in my life, I realized this last time I shared my story, it was the first time in my life I did what I was told to do, without fucking, without question, without an ulterior motive or an attempt at manipulating the situation. It was the first time I just said, okay, and did what I was supposed to do. And that first 6 months was really hard. It was so hard. I'd done so much damage at home that, you know, that, and I had tried to get sober for 6 years. Well, I got, from the time I had tried to get sober, I had been turned over to AA for 6 years. And so when you're going to AA, everybody around you, like, is it working? Is it working? You know, and it wasn't working for me. Or I wasn't working it, rather. I shouldn't say that. So, although I was trying to do the next right thing, everybody around me was like, you know, you want a freaking biscuit? Because what makes you think it's going to hold this time? And there was not too much faith in the fact, and I had a lot of resistance at home, which was really hard for me, because I would be like, don't you see how hard I'm trying? Why can't you just make a job? Don't you see how hard I'm trying? I think back, I was so like, you know. And they would just be like, whatever, Heather, you know, you're finally doing what you're supposed to do. But I wanted a pat on the back, and I didn't know how to behave from moment to moment. I remember one time, this is those funny things that stick out of my head, being in Best Buy and just wanting a drink, just because I didn't like feeling uncomfortable. I didn't like that I didn't have my armor. When I drank, it gave me this huge armor and this big personality. And this, I've always had a big voice and a big body, and I just thought I was really badass. And then that was all removed. I was so raw when I first got sober. I mean, I probably still could have thrown down, but I'd have been like, don't, you know. I was so fragile when I first got sober, and I hated feeling that way. I hated feeling vulnerable. Number one thing I still struggle with this to this day is my being vulnerable to another human being, and that's why I'm grateful for these opportunities that I put out there. But I remember being in Best Buy and just feeling like you were walking naked, you know what I mean? Like everybody's just looking at you and you have no defenses and you can't be like, stop looking! So I remember going in the bathroom and putting down a paper towel on the floor so I could get on my knees, because I always get on my knees when I pray. Since I have a resistance to authority, I feel like it's the one thing to do to show that I'm compliant. So I got on the knees on my knees in the bathroom in Best Buy and prayed to have God remove the urges and just to settle me down. And I used to do that crap all the time. And it's funny because I remember thinking, oh my God, is it always going to be like this? Like literally, I'm going to get in the public restroom everywhere I go and pray. And but it got me through that time. And I'm grateful that I had a program to show me, you know, that I had those options and that there was a different course that I could choose. Let's see, right when I got sober, I decided to start competing in bodybuilding. And everyone in AA warned me not to. They said it was too rigorous and it was too regimented and too restrictive, and I didn't need any huge major changes. But I told them that I wasn't hiding bottles and lying to everyone under the sun. There was a whole hell of a lot of free space up there that needed to be occupied. I had so much free space in my head, and I am extremely, we didn't have OCD and ADD when I was little. Heather's just high strung, you know. When I was little, we were on these diagnoses. It was just like, that girl's wound tight. So I had all this energy, and I needed to direct it somewhere. So I started competing to bodybuild the month that I got sober. which is, I think, for me, just for me, been instrumental in my sobriety. I started a business that year. I stayed sober for a year, and my parents and I made the decision that the kids would come back to me. Ended up being like a year and a half calendar-wise because of the way school fell. So, and that was hard when they came back. That was tough because just the challenges of being a mom again and trying to, you know, I finally put all the focus on me in the way that I needed to maintain me and my sobriety before that. And so them coming back home was an adjustment. And I'm an alcoholic that doesn't like change or adjustment. You know, I can get used to something within a day and then just keep it that way. So I started a business that year. Kids came back. A year and a half into competing, I earned my pro status in bodybuilding. And it's just the same stuff that I still do. I became very active in my program, and I started to like women. I worked with this woman. I started like women. That came out wrong. Sorry about that. It's cool. I don't have it. If it's these values, that's all good. But what I was trying to say was, when I got to AA, I hated women. Women had never been very nice to me. Growing up, when moving around, girls were not friendly. When I was new in school and good at sports and stuff, they were just nasty to me. And so I came here hating women. And so when I hooked up with my first female sponsor, who was the most loving, nurturing soul and such a godsend, because I needed someone to love on me, because I didn't have the ability to love on myself at all. And she was just a girly girl, unlike myself. In fact, I just remember being like, whoa, you know, and I just felt like I was being smothered, and I didn't like being touched. And but she was what I needed, and I would call her every morning, and she would pray, and she would make me, one of my assignments was to call another woman every day, because she knew I hated women. So I swear to God, I would call up a woman, I would be like, hey, this is Heather. I don't have shit to say, but fucking Michelle's making me call you. And people would laugh, and they'd be like, hi, Heather, how are you? And you know, and then we would be able to talk, and then I remember the first time that I had finally done enough of those calls that I was able to call a woman named Cindy when I was having a rough time and talk to her. And it was like a revelation to me to call another woman and say, like, yo, I'm not okay. Shit sucks, and I need some help. And, it was awesome, and it was freeing, but it still kind of makes me nervous. So I'm not there anymore. Now I can get down with chicks. I'm all right with chicks. This program, the female relationships that I have formed in here are something so strong and so important that I never would have had any idea if you had tried to explain to me. It's like explaining the word faith to someone when they have no concept or feeling of it. You can break it down in dictionary form, but you're like, okay, you know. But until you feel it, it's the same thing, right? The bonds and the strengths that I've formed from this program. Let's see here. A couple years later, I got married, and I was done having children since I pop them out two at a time. But my husband, who was younger than me, didn't have any of his own, and I thought, if there's something that you want to do and you can, you should. Ta-da! So we decided to have him. And this baby this baby has never seen me drunk. He knows a different mom than my girls did. Thank you to all of you. You know, this is a pretty well-adjusted kid that can sit here and be quiet for this period of time. Every day is like a field trip with him. Could you stop? it's such a different perspective being older and able to raise him sober. Such a blessing. And everything's different for me today. The fact that I like the woman that I see in the mirror. I like that I know that I have strengths and I have abilities that I'm not uncomfortable with now because of this program. And I'm not afraid to form friendships or be myself or extend kindness to others and to truly be present. I'm eternally grateful. And I share this in meetings when there's a newcomer. When we're little and we're in the sandbox and we're like, ooh, 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 I want to be a fireman, I want to be a policeman. Nobody ever says, I want to be an alcoholic, an addict, rape and pillage everything in my path. But if that's what I had to do to get to where I am, I think I won the freaking lottery. I am so grateful for this program. I often share, my kids work a 12-step program, we just don't call it a 12-step program at home. And to see the fruits of this program implemented into everyday life in every way around me is absolutely amazing and nothing short of a miracle. So I am so grateful to be sober, y'all, and thank you so much for having me, and thank you for letting me share.
Thank you.
All right. Wow. Thank you, Heather. Thank you so much. That was really, really powerful. I suspect there are people that are going to go home and throw out all their alcohol tonight after that. Personally, I'm going to go throw out all my sleeveless shirts. Some of us obviously should not wear sleeveless shirts. Okay. Thank you for that. You've ruined it. Thank you, you ruined it. What can I say? All right.
On that broad highway.